Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new Impactful Innovations podcast with JJ Snow. You're about to join JJ for another insightful, uplifting discussion with innovators who seek to make the world a better place and are led by their hearts to take on some of the toughest challenges facing humanity. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to Impactful Innovations, the podcast that's all about inspiring innovations and uplifting conversations. I'm your space racing tech host, JJ Snow, and today's show is going to be totally out of this world. Joining us today is Daniel Faber, the CEO and co-founder of OrbitFab. He's a serial entrepreneur and the creator of the next generation of in-space services and products ranging from space-based communications and Earth observation solutions to space-based mining, manufacturing, and tourism. Using his deep expertise in the aerospace and mining industries, Daniel has launched multiple successful high-tech companies, including most recently Deep Space Industries, which is aggressively advancing on the delivery of off-Earth resources to the space economy. Daniel holds multiple innovation awards and patents in mining, entertainment, and medical imaging, as well as aerospace. He is currently in the process of completing a double MBA at UCLA Anderson and the National University of Singapore, and also holds a degree in engineering from the University of New South Wales, as well as, most interestingly, a postgraduate certificate in Antarctic Studies from the University of Canterbury. Daniel, I'm so glad to have you on the show today. I know we have a lot of students and mentors at the Mentor Project who are big fans of space, and they're really excited to hear the latest on your efforts to make space more accessible to business and the public. So welcome on the show.
Thanks, JJ. Great to be here.
I am just such a big fan of what you've been building. My first question, and always the first question I have for entrepreneurs who are really just on the leading edge of their focus area, the area that they're most passionate about, is what got you into space to begin with? What got you started? Because you've got a background in aerospace and mining. What helped you make that jump? Was this something that early on in life you just really loved space, or was this something that kind of evolved over time as you started to work in different areas and you just saw it was like Reese's peanut butter cup, chocolate and peanut butter came together?
Well, I think my parents are partly to blame. My dad is an engineer. My mom is a scientist. And so I was probably doomed to do something technical. But growing up, they had a wall of science fiction. And so I read my way through that. And then I went to the local library and read the way through all of their science fiction. And then I found they had terminals that let me access the library network all over the state of Tasmania. So I was able to call in all of the science fiction all over Tasmania. I think I read all of it. Okay. And then I got to university and had to figure out what I wanted to do with myself. And I'm sure it was some of those ideas, but I decided I wanted something that would be an interesting career. We spend a lot of time in our careers and also something useful for the world. And getting people off this rock will address a bunch of existential risks. So that seemed like a very good thing to do. And it has proven to be quite interesting. So that's it. I've been trying to create the first permanent jobs in space since then. And for that, we need a bustling economy to support those jobs. And my list of things that might pay included tourism and mining. They were the only two industries that I could think of when I was in first year undergraduate that could justify the cost of the first permanent job in space. And I couldn't see myself as a tour operator. So I've been working on asteroid mining and related things ever since.
Oh, I love it. Okay, so let's talk about that, because I know what you've done most recently. I want to get to the gas stations in space and talking about those too, because this is super exciting. But let's talk about, you know, mining and space. I have a lot of people that say, oh, it's eons away. This is never going to happen. But it sounds like it's quite a bit closer than most people suspect. What are your feelings on that? And what technologies are you seeing today that are really going to help us make that leap to be successful in the mining industry in space?
Yeah, people have been talking about asteroid mining for decades, years. It's hard. when I started looking at it, I didn't know anything. So I just started trying to learn how to build spacecraft and thought, oh, how hard can this be? And so I was lucky enough, I got the opportunity to work on a dozen spacecraft. But then I was also sort of looking at the mining industry and how it worked And one of the things that I looked at was when you go to make a mine, you have to do exploration. You have to find out if the rocks actually exist, and then, you know, how hard they are to dig, and what sort of chemistry you need to be able to get the minerals out that you want and the metals. And so it was that sort of mining exploration phase that clearly we still need to do a lot of work with. And so that was sort of the genesis of the first company I started. I was looking at instruments that we might send to the moon or to asteroids to analyze the rocks, so that you don't have to have a whole wet lab. Because at the moment, you take the rocks and you dissolve the sample of rock in like really strong acids and things, and then you've got to put it through big expensive instruments to figure out what's in the rock. So we made a non-destructive system where we used some radiation chemistry. We threw neutrons at rocks and looked at the gamma rays coming back. And that was an idea to go and do sampling on the moon without having to have a wet lab. And we found out that the terrestrial mining industry were actually kind of interested in that technology as well. And so that was the base of the first company. But then through that, I got to know the mining industry and found out that really there were five sort of risk areas or five things that where if you make a big shift in any one of them, you can create a new paradigm shift in mining. And one of them is definitely this geology, right? Where are the rocks? If you figure out a new place to find rocks or a new way to identify where rocks with a high mineralization are, it can make a whole new paradigm in the mining industry. Another one, of course, is technology. Can you extract the minerals better than other people could, more cheaply? Another one is the market. Like, if people all of a sudden decided they want to buy a new type of mineral or a new metal or more of it or pay more for it. Another one is the regulatory environment. Sometimes for deep sea oil and gas, it was during the oil crisis in the late 70s that the U.S. government opened up the deep sea oil sort of prospects in the Gulf of Mexico, and that right. started the whole paradigm shift in oil and gas was a regulatory change. And then the last one is financing risk. You need to get enough money together to be able to overcome all the other risks and to build the technology and finish the, you know, finding out what's in the rocks, the geology and everything else. And sometimes money is cheap and sometimes money is expensive. Sometimes investors have a lot of money and will give it to you for something that's a bit more risky. And so all of those things can create, any one of those individually can create a paradigm shift. But what you need is them supported by, you need all of them to come together. And in asteroid mining, really none of those five things are at a suitable level yet. But
when do you think they will be? Because that's the question, right? Are we like 20 years away, or is it closer than that?
Yeah, that is the question. So if you look at those five things, the one that at the moment, there's a lot of money in the industry, a lot of money is getting invested in space. And it's quite possible that maybe somebody will look at it maybe a little bit philanthropically or something. Maybe someone will just say, look, here's my money. Go and do this, a billionaire or something like that. In which case, you can use that money to overcome the other risks. So it'll happen 5 years from the day that somebody says, well, here's the money, go and do it. And the question is, are we at that threshold yet or not? Do we know enough about the geology, the technology, the regulatory environment, and the market, are they mature enough just to get somebody over the line to say, to make that investment? And that investment now, with the costs coming down with smaller satellites and everything else, the investment need is probably on the order of $50 million. Mm-hmm. And 5 years, like maybe even 3 years after somebody drops $50 million on it, we'll have the first sort of pilot small-scale mining operation, basically a trial mining campaign. So it could be underway at the moment and we just don't know about it. Or it could be 5 years away, or we might not have anybody drop that check on it for another 5 or 10 years.
And do you think that they will be mining specific asteroids that are more predictable, or do you think that they'll go to maybe the moon to start mining there first and then take those technologies and techniques and then start to track down the asteroids that are most valuable?
Oh, this is almost a religious debate. Should we be mining the moon or the asteroid?
I know, I've opened a can of worms.
Oh, you have. I love this one. So I'm on the asteroid side. The asteroids have the advantage. We actually have a better idea of what's inside the asteroids because we have meteorites that fall from the sky. And we can match the reflection spectra of the meteorites, basically what color they are, to the reflection spectra of the asteroids, what color the asteroids are that we see through telescopes. And they match pretty well. And so we can say that these asteroids we're looking at, their surface must be almost entirely covered in the same material that we have in some of the meteorites, and there's like 20 different classes. And so that gives us a good idea of the minerals that are in the asteroid. The moon, we've only actually got samples from about a dozen places where the Apollo program and the Russian program went to. So we know less about the geology and the geological context of the moon than we do about the asteroids, which is really curious.
Yeah, that's surprising, because I think a lot of people would expect the opposite, right? Very interesting. So let's jump to your most recent initiatives, which I'm really excited about, because if we are going to have an economy in space, we've got to start setting up the infrastructure. And let's talk about what you've been doing in that area. Let's talk about gas stations in space. Let's talk about that, because I was just so blown away when you shared the work that you're doing. And I know our students are excited to hear about this too.
Yeah. So when I was working at Deep Space Industries, we had the big, hairy, audacious goal of asteroid mining. We actually went out there and said, we are going to mine asteroids. And then we tried and we failed because we couldn't buy a thruster that could move the satellite out, the spacecraft out to the asteroid. So we built a thruster instead. But in one way, what we were building, when you think about those five risk areas again, there was no market for material. The market on Earth, you could sell metals and things on Earth, but there's already mines on Earth. There's lots of metals in the Earth. And so you're competing against terrestrial mines. But in space, one of the resources that we need is fuel. We need fuel just to move satellites around, to put them in the right orbit. If you want to go to the moon and back, it takes a lot of fuel. And it's one of the biggest limitations. It's so expensive to launch fuel because it's just heavy. Right. And so if we can get the fuel from asteroids or the moon and bring that into Earth orbit and sell it, then you could make a decent amount of money and you could like fund a mining operation. And so we built a thruster that could run off fuels that one day you could get from an asteroid, because all the thrusters didn't, like they used things that you couldn't find on asteroids. There are some elements and minerals that just don't exist on asteroids or the moon. So we built the thruster that could run on water. And now there are like a lot of other companies have had the same idea and they've found really good ways to use these new propellants. So that was my last company. But then step two, once you've got the equipment that you can use these material, you have to have a market, right? You have to have people buying and selling the material. And so that's what we're doing now. So the company Orbit Fab, we set up 3 years ago, and we talked to people and said, would you like to buy fuel? And they said, yes. And so, well, how much would you pay for it? And they said, well, a lot. In fact, $1 million for 1 kilogram of fuel. That's how much money they can make extra. Wow. Because they can keep moving their satellite around. $1 million for 1 kilogram. So that's huge. We're like, well, we can launch fuel for cheaper than that. Well, why isn't everybody doing this? Well, there was no fueling port, so we had to make a fueling port. And then there was no standard rendezvous and docking solution. Like, you couldn't bring two spacecraft together. They go to space and they sit there all lonely. And so we're trying to work on that and define what that interface will be. And then we start to build, finally, the tankers and the actual fuel supply. So that's it. We're building gas stations in space.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So how did you come up with the idea to actually be able to do the refuel? I mean, these satellites are already up there. Some of them have been up there for many years. How did you come up with that idea? I mean, and not even being able to look at the satellite close up, you're working off of schematics, some that may be old or erroneous, and you're trying to match that with new technologies. There's a lot of intricacy that's happening, and you're in a very complex environment. What was that like, and how did you generate those ideas with your team?
We actually cheat a little bit on that. So when we started looking at it and thinking, you know, let's solve this problem of like not enough fuel in space, what we found was that there are a few companies that were building tow trucks in space. Tow trucks, right? Yeah. Previously, you put up a satellite, nobody ever touched it again. Like, you never saw it again. It was in space. You could communicate it through radio, and that was it. And then the technology for bringing spacecraft together for rendezvous and docking. I mean, we've done it with people before. We've done it with space stations and things like that. But to do it just with robots, right, that needed a lot of testing. And so the US government and other people started testing this, and you know, there were a few mistakes that they made, and they learned how to do it. And now we have that capability in technology. Computers are better, cameras are better, all that kind of thing. And so it had crossed this threshold. So 3 years ago, when we were looking to start, there were like 8 or 9 companies trying to build tow trucks in space, either just to tow satellites around or to like attach on them and take over when they ran out of fuel, like they could act like a jetpack. Right. Or just to do inspections or maybe small robotic repairs. So there are 8 or 9 companies. There are now 46 companies. It's like five times as many 3 years later, because everyone's realized this is a thing. We can build tow trucks to fix satellites and tow them around. And they have to build like all the complex robotics, because like you said, you've got to rely on like the schematics, and you haven't seen the satellite for years. And,
right.
And that's really, really tricky. We took the easy problem. We said, your tow truck is going to run out of fuel. Why don't you refill the tow truck? And yeah. So they do all the difficult stuff, and we just give the tow truck companies the fueling cap, and then they can get fuel from us. So that's it. We absolutely cheating.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's brilliant. No, I love it. I love it. So this is based, I mean, just that 3-year segment, we're seeing such an increase in activity. I mean, from launches to robotics, what's next? What do you see as the next steps that we need? What kind of technologies do we need to achieve that next level of, you know, setting up a space station that's in orbit, or setting up manufacturing in orbit? What would be the next technology that, you know, if you were king for a day, that you would like to see in space working and ready to go?
Well, let me go back to first year university and what I was thinking then. My list of industries that I thought could pay for the first permanent job in space was tourism and mining.
Right.
Now we've got other things that are happening, which is great. My list is much longer. It's got in-space manufacturing. Right. Tom Cruise wants to shoot a movie. We could have like a whole entertainment industry in space. I think there's enormous potential there. Yeah, of course, the tourism is happening. What you have to think about is, as soon as there's a first permanent job in space, whatever industry that happens to be, as soon as we get that first permanent job, we don't want to bring that person back to the Earth, because that's expensive. So what right. we want to do is keep them happy in orbit so they'll stay there longer.
Right.
So then you need to have somebody there to like cook them food and make sure they're productive and make sure they're happy, like fix the toilets, because they're terrible apparently.
I've heard that.
Yeah. You want to have what is effectively an internal economy job. And if you look at most economies, like every export job supports 10 or 100 internal economy jobs. And so if you think about that, the thing that we're lacking most in space is these export jobs: tourism, mining, manufacturing for export, tourism content, all these kind of things. And then you start to have people living in space, and we need houses, we need food production, farming, we need hospitals, medical care, we need education facilities. Everything that exists on Earth, we're going to need in space. But we've got to cross that threshold with the first permanent job, and then the second, and then the third, and watch it totally expand and take off. So that's what's really exciting to me. I think that tourism will probably be first, though maybe the entertainment content stuff. I think that maybe robots will do most of the mining, but there's a lot of things you just can't run an entertainment park without people. You can't run a hotel without people. That's the threshold. So that's what's most exciting to me, is the fact that we can get humans to space now. SpaceX is launching, Blue Origin and others are chasing that. I think even Rocket Lab's new launch vehicle might be man-rated soon. In 5-10 years, I expect that we're going to have lots of options for getting people into space, and people are going to actually start being able to live there to do these jobs that are available. That's the biggest thing, bar none. And of course, they're all going to need fuel to move their spacecraft around. They're all going to need air and water and lubricants and 3D printer feedstock. And that's what Orbit Fab is. We're the materials supply chain.
Well, and didn't you guys provide water to the International Space Station too?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we ran a test. We put up 2 test bed tankers inside the International Space Station. The astronauts had to move them around and made sure they're all working, and then hooked them up to the space station and pumped the water across so that the astronauts are drinking the water that we flew up to space station. And a funny story on that, we had to get like deionized water. It had to be very clean, because you don't want to contaminate the space station.
Right.
And especially with the drinking water. So we went to Safeway, and they sell deionized water. And so we bought the water, And then NASA, they want to make sure that it's clean. It turns out if you go onto the website and you poke around, you can find the certificate that they have for when they cleaned the water.
Oh my
we
God.
Uploaded that to NASA, and so we sent up Safeway water to the space station.
That's fantastic. So there we go, groceries in space. It's already happening.
Yep.
I love it. If you had to guess, Daniel, and it, only a guess, if you had to guess, what would be the most likely first permanent job in space for a person?
Oh, I think it's going to be the butler, like the person who runs the space hotel. Like they've got to be the electrician and replace the lights. They've got to be the chef. They've got to roll out the carpet and sweep the floors and keep the windows clean. That person just running the space hotel, I think that is going to be the first commercial, like permanent job in space.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That sounds like a great first job. That might be a job that I would, once I retire again after I retire, that might be a job I'd volunteer for, provided I decide to retire one day. So, wow, there's so many questions I have, and I know our students have so many different questions as well. And you know, you're moving forward, you're doing the gas stations in space. What is another area that really wants to focus on in addition to that? Because I'm hearing a lot of discussions around space-based communications, space-based internet. Are you guys looking to do anything in those areas, or how would that tie in with the efforts that you're building out?
So we're building that propellant and material supply chain. We're like an infrastructure company, if you like. So firstly, we just work on delivering fuels, eventually perhaps delivering other things like air and water and other things people need. But we believe that once you have the materials in space, you should just convert them into whatever you need so that you can recycle them and reuse them and eventually get the material from the moon and asteroids and bring that into the propellant supply chain and the material supply chain. So we want to just be a chemicals and sort of petrochemicals company, making all the chemicals that are needed for life and the economy in orbit. That's our goal. So we already have projects for processing propellant in orbit, turning it from one type of chemicals into other types of chemicals that are useful in different situations. That's where we're going.
That's got to be really exciting because, I mean, anything to do with material sciences and the opportunity to actually potentially exploit new materials that aren't found on Earth, I mean, that's got to be a really exciting place to be because you may find new propellants, you may find new materials that can do things that we've never been able to do before. Is that part of the appeal for what you're building as well? You're basically, you know, Star Trek, where no man has gone before.
It's one of the things that I find most exciting about what we're doing right now in space. The if you think back 150, 200 years ago, okay, I wasn't alive back then. Imagine 200 years ago. somebody invented a vacuum pump. They could remove the air from something. And you've got to think that's pretty useless. Yay, I now have a container with no air. And over the next 100 years, industry and life completely changed.
Right.
Because that's what you need for refrigeration. It's what you need for so many chemical processes and things like that. The industrial availability of vacuum, where you just took away air, changed so much in industry. What we are on the brink of now is being able to do things in space where we can take away gravity. And gravity is, it's the force that organizes matter at a macroscopic scale. All buoyancy, like separation of fluids and everything else, we're about to just be able to remove that.
Right.
And we will do things that have never been imagined. Now, what will we do with it? I don't know. What do you do with a box with no air in it? What you do is you let a whole bunch of entrepreneurs and smart people think about it and come up with things and try things. And over the next 100 years, everything will change.
Oh, and that's interesting too, because now you're talking about it an open source, crowdsourced opportunity for the next generation of manufacturing in space. So how do people play in that? Is that something that they'll be able to do remotely? Is that something that will be a hybrid mix where you'll have people in space as well as on the Earth that will be teaming up around this? Because that's really exciting to see what kind of ideas will generate from large groups of bright minds coming together around these problems.
Oh, you got it. I think it's going to be a hybrid approach. But most exciting is that really the problem we have at the moment is everybody grows up with gravity.
Right.
Everybody's used to gravity. And we expect that when you drop something, it hits the floor and breaks.
Right.
So few people, I think it's like 600 people or so, have actually been to space and started to experience that. And the number of people that have spent more than 6 months there is like you're starting to get to very small numbers. Right. When somebody's in space and that's their home and they're going to live there for a long time, maybe the rest of their life, they're going to start looking at it differently and thinking about it differently and experiencing it differently. And they're just going to intuitively know that when you drop a cup, it doesn't shatter on the floor.
Right.
And when you put a bubble inside liquid, it doesn't pop out the side. It just kind of hangs in the middle of the liquid and you can completely isolate things without having to touch them and without having to have strong walls. And all of a sudden, just things start to change. But nobody has experience to be able to intuitively think about that. In order to do that, we need people in space. We need them there long enough. And we need to give them free time to just play around with things. And one day someone will just go, oh, that's weird. I could use that for this thing. And away you go. You'll just have this explosion of inventions. So, yeah, just getting more people sort of in touch with that. And then, of course, on the ground, we want to find the applications. What can you make in space that you can bring to the ground that will be super useful? And yeah, there'll be a lot of people trying to analyze these things as we discover more interesting stuff that we can do without gravity.
Yeah. So let me go back to something you said earlier. You mentioned your mom and dad were a big inspiration because of their interest in science fiction and science fact. Would you credit them as, you know, the reason that you really took to this area? And, you know, for what they did growing up and you were around them and seeing their work, was that also part of the drive for you and getting really excited about this area? Because a lot of our students will ask, well, who was your inspiration? Was it a teacher? Was it a parent? Was it, where did that come from? So you mentioned your mom and dad. I'd be curious to hear a bit more about them.
Yeah. So I can remember, I think I was like 3 or 4 years old and my dad was explaining water molecules to me. I always sort of had that. Science was just part of the conversation. My parents are infinitely curious. Yeah. And so, yeah, that was pretty interesting. But they also, I think, made a decision never to give me their like opinion, never to try and push me in any direction. And right. So that whenever I would ask for their advice, they would say, oh, that's important. Have you made a list of the pros and cons? I'm really good at lists now.
I bet. Oh, I love that, though, because they were really challenging you to develop your own perspective and explore. And that's so important. A lot of the people that I interview and that, you know, are part of the Mentor Project that are entrepreneurs have that explorer nature about them. And I think that's really important for an entrepreneur, but also for somebody that is working in the tech field. I'd be curious to get your take on that, because having that natural curiosity and that propensity to, you know, branch out and try new things in unexpected ways or in dynamic environments that others haven't done, that seems to be one of those core foundational components for a successful technologist or a successful scientist or entrepreneur.
Yeah, absolutely. And I reminded of something that I heard when I was at high school. And you should always have good advisors, right? Good people that have been there and know a lot. Listen to them. They'll tell you what can't be done and why. And then go and do it anyway.
I love that. Yes. That's fantastic. And the other thing a lot of our students will say, because we have a lot of young entrepreneurs that have bright ideas, and they'll say when they come in and they're talking to us, hey, people tell me my idea is dumb, that it won't work, that I'm thinking too big, that it's not possible. What would you have to say to that?
Every idea is dumb and crazy until the day that it works.
That's
every funny. Idea. Here's something really fascinating. I'm in Silicon Valley now, and I ended up moving here just because there were people who were thinking like this, and I think it's more prevalent now in the world. But in Silicon Valley, they're trying to build companies, and what you find is if you have the same idea as everybody else, you've got nothing new. You're building a commodity, right? Everybody's just undercutting themselves on price because everybody's got the same thing. What you need is something that's different. And for it to be different and valuable, it has to be contrarian, right? It has to be something that not everyone believes will work. Otherwise, everyone's doing it. So you have to be contrarian and you have to be right, of course, which is, it's easy to be contrarian and wrong. And it's easy to be right and just part of the consensus. What's really tricky is to be contrarian and right. And that's what the venture capitalists are always trying to figure out is, do you have an idea that is both contrarian and right? So every time someone says that will never work or that's a terrible, crazy idea, always take that as validation that you're contrarian.
I love that.
And to know whether you're right or not, that's got to come from inside you, because you've got to figure it out for yourself and prove to yourself and learn more about what you're trying to do than anyone else in the world. Because if you don't, then to believe that it's right, you're not contrarian, right? You've got to do that yourself. And that's the hard work of building a company and changing the world, is to figure out the contrarian things that are actually right.
So another question that a lot of our students will come in with are, you know, I don't want to necessarily go to college and get an advanced degree, but I do want to work in this field and I do want to learn the right skills, or maybe I do want to get a degree, but I'm not sure where to start. If we had students that wanted to get into the space economy and what's coming next, what would be your advice? Where would you tell them to go? And especially if maybe they're not in a big city, maybe they're in a small town or a village someplace, and they might have internet access, or where should they start?
Well, I grew up on a farm in Tasmania.
Oh my gosh.
You don't know, that's at an island off the bottom of Australia. It's about the end of the world.
I love it.
And so you know, here I am. Don't let that stop you. The important thing, you don't need a university degree, but they're useful places to learn. I spent most of my time at university learning and not studying, because I found that what they wanted to teach me wasn't necessarily what I wanted to learn. Yeah. And that there's a difference in that. And you don't need a university to learn. But this comes back to what I said before. If you want to know that your idea is right when nobody else thinks it is, you've got to know more about it than everybody else. And you've got to figure out a way to solve it that other people have clearly missed. And for that, you just need to know a lot. So learn. That is the most important thing. Figure out ways to learn things that other people haven't figured out yet. And that can mean learning how to use your hands and make things. It can mean learning how to think and how to calculate. It can mean learning how to ask questions. That can be really the most powerful one, is learning how to ask questions. And then put all of that together to come up with the ideas that you want to test out. Test them out, and most of them will probably fail, because finding the thing that nobody else believes that's right means finding a lot of things that no one else believes that is a good reason they don't believe them. So you got to try that a lot of times. But really, just keep learning, keep testing, keep looking, and there's no reason to ever stop doing that. And it can be a lot of fun. And most importantly, you need to be having fun, because it can take a lot of time to come up with these things and change the world.
And I think that fun and passion is really important in finding the work, your life's work that's going to be impactful, that's going to be fulfilling. And that's something that you know, I've had a number of mentors that have stressed to me as well. I'm curious, Daniel, do you have any mentors or anyone in your network that stands out as, you know, you were going through one of those moments where somebody said, oh, gas stations in space, this guy's crazy, where they stepped up and they said, actually, no, let's play around with that idea. And, you know, let's tease that out a little bit. And they just stood out to you. How does that network or those friendships or those mentors come into play when maybe you're coming up against a wall or you've come up against a series of failures?
Oh yeah, that's super important. But what you find is if you start pushing on something and you're curious and you're asking questions and everything, you'll find the people that want to see it happen. You'll find the other people that believe in the thing that most people don't. And you should always assume that they don't necessarily have the right ideas either, but they will tend to help you. So on the asteroid mining side, I managed to connect, luckily, early in my career with some people building some of the most cutting-edge small spacecraft, and then people who were looking at mining, at asteroid mining, and things like that. And John Lewis wrote the book on asteroid mining, and I ended up working with him. It was amazing. But I can remember the first time that I met him, I managed to get a trip to NASA Ames here in Silicon Valley.
And very cool.
Yeah, and he was living in Arizona, and he came over for this event, And I just sort of sat there and went, oh my gosh, I've read like six of your books and now here in the room. It was really cool.
Yeah.
And then fast forward like 10 years and I'm working with him at Deep Space Industries. That was one of the most amazing things. And gosh, such a brilliant mind. He wrote the book on asteroid mining in like the 1980s. I think he's now written about 20 of them of like every aspect of asteroid mining. Absolutely brilliant. And you find these people. There are other people in that company similarly that they'd just spent a long time looking at things in great detail, trying to figure out how to solve these problems and how to make them real.
That's absolutely incredible. And that had to be a really good feeling where here's somebody that you've admired and that you've been learning from, and now you're working alongside of them and building something together. That's got to be a really awesome feeling.
It was pretty amazing. We ended up with a couple of people like that. The other person who was there at Deep Space Industries was Julian Melnick, who was the founder of a company called Nautilus Minerals. This is a mining company that wants to mine nickel and silver and gold and zinc from the bottom of the seafloor, like a mile underneath the surface of the ocean.
Wow.
And he completely pioneered that. He set that company up. Absolutely amazing. And I remember somebody was reaching out to him. I'm like, look, if you can get John Lewis, who wrote the book on astro mining, and Julian Melnick, who set up this world's first undersea hard rock mining company, into the same room. I work for free. That was amazing. And like a few months later, we had them and they didn't even need me to work for free. It was great.
Wow. That's awesome. That's super, super cool. Okay. Let me ask another question. And this one is an important one. Probably more important than any of the others. For our aspiring innovation students, our youth entrepreneurs, they're starting their own journeys. And, you know, we've got some in middle school, some in high school, and some in college and that are venturing out and trying this out for their first time. What is one piece of advice that you would share to them? If you could only share one piece of advice, what would you have to say to them as they start on their own journeys?
Be persistently curious. Be persistent because finding the things that are worth doing is not easy. Finding the things that are worth doing, you want to keep pushing at that because a lot of people will tell you that your ideas are not right. But be curious. Find out why they think that. And then, like I said, listen to their advice and then go and do it anyway. Keep asking the questions. Why don't you think that will work, right? That's it. If you can just be persistently curious, you'll end up going great places.
Daniel, I don't want to end our interview because this has been so much fun. And I so appreciate everything that you're doing. Thanks so much for being on the show today. This is fantastic. I can't wait to see what you're up to next because I know it's going to be amazing. And I hope we can get you back on the show in the future for the Mentor Project. And then thanks to ITSP Magazine for sponsoring us and Squadcast, of course. And Daniel, really, really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, JJ, and I hope to see a lot of your listeners around the space industry fairly soon.
I know they would love that, and definitely don't be a stranger for the Mentor Project either.
You bet.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Impactful Innovations Podcast with JJ Snow. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.